Our format is that we'll go around the room for both introductions of who's here from the TCAC as well as where they're from, and also a sound check. So I'll start with John, who's the farthest away, and see if you can hear him. And if you can't hear him, and we'll make every effort to speak up.
John Dorn from Mankato.
Did you hear John?
I did.
Okay, great. Good.
Janet Lexon from Lakeville.
Hi, Tim Hipsch from Maple Grove.
Yvonne Condell Moorhead.
Dave Larkin, Bemidji.
Carolyn Williams, St. Cloud.
Kent Eklund, St. Paul.
Earl Rasmussen, Blaine.
Zainab Hassan, New Brighton.
Donovan Bailey, Rochester.
Sonia Honadel Moorhead.
Marilyn Cathcart, Minneapolis.
Nancy Black. Hi, Tom. Minneapolis.
Carl Crimmins, Champlin.
Did you hear Carl?
I did.
Great. Okay. Then
everybody came through loud and clear.
Good. Good. Well, we'd like to ask you to make an opening statement, 3 to 5 minutes or however long you want, and then we'll have open questions. And then in about 40 minutes, we'll ask you to make a closing comment and send you back into the sun.
Well, thank you.
So, Tom, opening statement's yours.
All right. Thank you very much. Good morning, all. My name is Tom Rainier, and as you know, I'm a candidate for the 8th District seat, which I currently occupy on the Board of Trustees of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. First of all, I want to thank you for accommodating my schedule in this way. I realize that it's a lot better to interview someone who's sitting in front of you, and I really, really appreciate your flexibility in all of this. First thing I want you all to do is imagine that I'm in the room and that I'm wearing an appropriate dark business suit.
Yeah, sure.
A white starch dress shirt and a striped tie, as opposed to what I'm actually wearing, which we won't talk about. I'll start with giving a very, very brief background of myself. I know you've already read some of that on my application. I'm a lifelong Duluthian. I'm blessed with my wife, Debbie, and three wonderful children. Dana, who is a special education teacher in New Brighton. She and her husband live there with my two grandsons. Emily, our high school senior, who is currently torn between attending the U of M in the Twin Cities and Minnesota State University, Mankato. And Bill, our high school sophomore, who is far too busy thinking about things like soccer and tennis and sophomore girls to be weighing college options. I'm a graduate of the U of M Duluth. I've spent my entire working career focused on northeastern Minnesota, the seven-county Arrowhead region. Early in my career, I worked in the field of economic and community development, working for and with boards consisting primarily of local elected officials. 24 years ago, approximately, I was very fortunate to be given the opportunity to start a new organization that exists today as the Northland Foundation, which is one of the McKnight Initiative Foundations, which I'm sure most of you are familiar with. In my capacity as president of the foundation, I work at the pleasure of a 13-member board of trustees representing the business community, the nonprofit community, and the education community. Briefly, the foundation over its history has distributed over $25 million in grants to nonprofits, over $45 million in loans to for-profit businesses, and has delivered over $15 million worth of programs benefiting children and youth. The foundation has fared well these last few years despite a very harsh investment climate, and currently manages over $56 million in assets. I've worked on both sides of the board table, having served on a number of local, regional, and national boards, the most notable of which I listed on my application. I'll just list a couple for you. The Leibovitz School of Business and Economics at UMD, the Opportunity Finance Network, which is a national member-supported organization of the premier nonprofit business and housing lenders in the country, APEX, which is an Area Partnership for Economic Expansion. I'm a founding member of that in northeastern Minnesota. The Duluth LISC organization. LISC is a local initiative support corporation, also a founding board member. And a few others, Minnesota Center for Rural Policy, the Minnesota Humanities Commission, and I even did a nice stint on the Minnesota Twins Community Fund. But most importantly, and the service that prompted me 6 years ago to limit my service on other boards, is my tenure as a trustee of the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. Despite the challenging economic environment resulting in severe cuts to higher education, I have thoroughly enjoyed my service on this important governing board. 3 of the last 4 years, I've served as chair of the Finance, Facilities, and Technology Committee. As you know, this is the committee that establishes the annual operating budget, including tuition, as well as oversees the capital improvement program, building, renovating, and maintaining our physical plants on 54 campuses throughout the state. Early on in my tenure, the then Chair Bob Hoffman asked if I would serve as liaison between the Minsky Board of Trustees and the Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College Board. The relationship had deteriorated substantially between the college and tribal leadership to the point where the college was at risk of losing its unique mission and status as an accredited tribal college, as well as the significant revenue that comes with that status. I feel that my efforts in that role helped reestablish trust and get them on the right path. Although challenges remain, I'm very proud of the considerable progress that's been made. I've had the great pleasure of working alongside Jim McCormick and view him as a trusted colleague and a friend. I believe that Chancellor McCormick is one of the most visionary leaders in higher ed today. I feel that the challenges and innovations he's made over the 9 years as chancellor are remarkable and have set the stage for his successor to take the system to an even higher level. I want very much to be part of selecting a new leader and assisting him or her in making the system into what its legislative framers intended and what it must become if it is to continue to serve the educational and workforce needs of the state. With that, Mr. Chair and members, I will stop and stand for questions.
Thank you, Tom. You alluded to the succession issue. Can you talk a little bit about experiences you may have had as a board member during leadership transitions?
I take a very active role in my own organization in terms of recruitment and orientation and so on of my board of trustees. Obviously, that is their prerogative. They're a self-perpetuating board. They vote themselves on. But I feel as a CEO, it's very important that I assist emerging leaders on the board and help them to become strong chairs if that's their desire. We generally don't put the usual suspects on our board. We put emerging leaders from around the region, people who haven't had that much opportunity to engage in leadership roles, and we hope that they grow in their leadership skills during their tenure on our board, and many of them have. I'm involved right now with the transition of Catherine Martin as Chancellor of UMD. I'm not part of the search committee per se, but I'm part of a panel on the Leibowitz School that is contributing their input into that process. I'm dealing with my own succession. I've been in my position for going on 25 years, quarter of a decade. Unless I do something really dramatically wrong, I suspect this will be the last job I hold. And as founding CEO 25 years ago, I'm dealing with all of those issues that accompany that, as is my board. I have presented with that to them in the last year a pretty detailed succession plan. I am I am having all of my senior staff who are right behind me in age and in tenure do the same. So succession planning is becoming more and more a necessary, as so many of us boomers are looking to retire in the next few years. Succession planning has really come to the top of priority for most businesses and organizations. And so I've been engaged in a number of ways, and I think that this transition from Chancellor McCormick to whomever is going to take his place is just a really, really critical one.
Carl?
Yes, my name is Carl Crimmins. Tom, I'd like to ask, what would you look for? What is the greatest attribute the new chancellor should bring to Minsky?
Well, somebody asked me that in a different way, and I'll try and frame that my answer that way. But somebody asked me, what's the most challenging thing that a new chancellor will have to do? That's something that I think Chancellor McCormick has done extremely well, and that is establish the right balance and the right relationship with the presidents of the system. And that just takes a tremendous amount of leadership and tact, understanding of this critical friction between a system that's trying very, very hard to become a system and function as such, a collection of colleges and universities that existed in some form or fashion prior to the system being formed. And managing that balance of giving those presidents the room that they need to function as presidents, the independent decision-making to function as presidents, and yet being a chancellor, a leader, that can muster all of those forces, those considerable forces of those 32 institutions with the presidents behind them 100%. And I think that just takes a huge amount of management savvy and clear understanding of the mission of the system and the ability to create strong relationships of trust with those presidents. As I said, I think Jim McCormick has done a superb job of that. I think, there's a management team in place, the vice chancellors and so on. They can take a lot of the day-to-day, month-to-month management burden off of the chancellor, but managing those relationships between the office of the chancellor and the chancellor personally and those 32 presidents, I think, is going to take just a huge amount of leadership and insight.
Thank you.
Sameet?
Zainab Hassan, I would like to know, since you have been part of the Minsky board, what have you learned and what do you think are the top challenges that you have to overcome?
What have I learned? Well, I've learned a great deal just about the system itself, but I think I've learned more about the population of Minnesota and the students and the relationship between those Minsky institutions and their communities. The economic viability of so many of these communities is really dependent upon those colleges and universities succeeding. I've learned a lot about how to do more with less. the phrase we've all said so many times in the last number of years. This situation with the state and its deficit and its impact on higher ed and education generally, all the way from early childhood through higher ed, has taught me a lot about trying to work with people across the table and trying to compromise and creating efficiencies And in a system that big, it's extremely difficult to know when you start cutting, whether you're cutting excess or you're cutting inefficiencies or those things, or you're cutting services to students and quality. And I think particularly as chair of the Finance and Facilities Committee, I've learned to dig beneath the surface of those budgets and try and ferret out whether or not a cut that's being made, whether it's in the office of the chancellor or across the entire system, is a cut that is essential, appropriate, and doable, again, without cutting services to students who need them so badly, without cutting quality. You know, we have a strategic plan that is essentially based on the fundamental of quality. No matter what you get into any of those points in the strategic plan, it's all about doing it the right way for students. And I'm very afraid that we're at the point now where if we have to continue to cut, both in the office of the chancellor and on the campuses, that we are indeed chipping away at that quality that we aspire to. But I think I've learned how to delineate between the two, and I think my contribution through the Finance and Facilities Committee has been just that, to try and distinguish cuts that are appropriate and cuts that that really, really damage the system.
Janet?
Tom, this is Janet Lexon. I'm kind of asking the hot seat question, so to speak, here. There was some somewhat a controversial issue on bonuses given to the chancellor and various presidents of the college. What was your position on this decision, and can you defend it one way or the other?
My position is that they were totally appropriate. I think it was a really awkward and bad mistake calling them bonuses. I think that we're paid. I think if you listen to the governor talk for years and listen to others within the system, many people on the board, pay for performance is a good way to go. And this was pay for performance. And I was aware of the incentives and the goals for the college president. I was aware of the process that was used to determine whether or not they got some, all, or none, and some got all and some got none, based on their performance in accomplishing specific goals. I think calling it a bonus was a huge mistake, because obviously this is not the time where we start handing out bonuses to people. And so I had no problem with it. The fact of the matter is that if you lined it up with the IFO increases from that prior year and so on, they were entirely consistent. They just weren't automatic. So there was a timing issue and there was a PR issue. But from the standpoint of making, setting out goals, achievable but aggressive goals for the presidents, and then judging whether or not they accomplished those goals and then paying them accordingly, I was on board with it. I think it was mishandled, along with the chancellor's quote unquote bonus. That was a performance issue. Specific goals, were set out for the chancellor at the beginning of the year. And I say this in the context of the economic environment, but, if you look at what the chancellor's salary, and the way the chancellor's salary has been handled over the last, since I've been on the board, has been totally appropriate. I'm aware that some legislators are promoting some cap on the chancellor's salary, that would be ridiculously low. And I am so concerned about attracting the top candidate in the world to run this system, and we're not going to be able to recruit such a person if we don't offer an appropriate amount of pay for someone who runs a system that's this massive and this complicated.
Nancy?
Hi, Tom. I'm not going to get into a discussion with you about your statement concerning the IFO and the pay incentive bonuses and pay for performance. We agree that we disagree about your statement. But having said that, in your essay to us, and I'm very glad you're reapplying, by the way, is that you said that there needs to be an adjustment in the spending priorities. And along these lines, then, in following up, can you tell us going forward what those adjustments might be?
Well, if I recall what I wrote in my application, when I'm talking about adjustments there, I'm talking about at the policy level at the state, between whoever is the next governor and the legislature and so on. I understand the state has a deficit. I understand you can't just go print money. But on the other hand, I think I referred to Dr. Art Rolnick in that comment. And what I'm talking about there is despite a $5 billion deficit, the state still spends, I don't know what it is, $30 billion or something a year. And I feel that priorities are out of whack when education generally is not funded fully, early childhood all the way through higher ed. If we don't make the investment in early childhood, we pay the price all the way through grade school, middle school, high school, and we end up with a great portion of our students not being college ready. So to me, those are the priority adjustments and shifts that I was referring to. However, if we want to translate that comment down specifically to Minsku, I think I'll go back to the point I made earlier, and that is it's a huge system. There's a theory that there's always room for more cuts. There's always places that can be cut. But I just don't, and I think those are appropriate, and we have to do our share, but I just don't ascribe to the so-called starve the beast mentality that there's always more fat to be cut. There are always places to move from one place to another in an appropriate manner. And to me, it's the critical judgment is this expenditure, is this line item, is this program specifically serving students and the mission of Minsku? And are we offering our students what we say we are? If it doesn't apply to that philosophy or that priority, then it needs to be examined, and perhaps money needs to be moved away from something like that. But and it's not always an easy judgment. But to me, that's the main criteria: is are we getting to the point now where we are making it more difficult to enter college and succeed at college, and most importantly, to graduate. And if there are places that can be cut that don't impact that specific priority, then we ought to look very seriously at them and move resources out of them. That's a heady decision. It's why a solid cohesive collegial board of trustees is so critical because it all, you know, that decision stops there, and it's not getting any easier.
I think you're going to be hearing from a lot of students given the cut in programs and faculty at the institutions, and I know you share all of our concern about students first. So, and thank you for your answer, and thank you for your service.
Oh, thank you, Nancy.
Earl?
I have one question. I know this governor doesn't want to raise taxes, but don't you think we have to raise taxes in order to take care of these university students?
uh,
I put you in a hot seat. Sorry about that.
We're still on a schedule where I'm hoping, despite my political leanings, to be reappointed by this guy.
Okay.
So I hope that
takes care of it. Thank you.
I do believe that that there are solutions to this state's economic issues, and some of them is moving priorities and spending money that we don't consider spending, but we consider investing. I have a long career in economic development. I talked about Dr. Rolnick and the huge return on investment in early childhood education. In the crazy world where I'm governor, I don't do share pain, but everybody shares equally in the pain. I sit and look at what can the state invest in that brings a return. Education is one of those things. Strong economic development programs that create jobs are obviously another. Because there's two ways to increase taxes. One is to just create a new tax or raise current taxes, and the other is to generate more tax revenue with more economic activity. And I think the solution lies across that whole spectrum.
Thank you.
Sonia?
This is Sonia Honado from Moorhead. You talked earlier in reference to being ready and making succession plans and about the baby boomers retiring. Can you share with us ideas you have used already with the trustees or that you have now about how we will be able to replenish, how Minsky will be able to replenish our workforce? What have you talked about, and what would you like to bring to the table in reference to doing that?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
What kind of plans does Minsky have in reference to recruitment, retention, and graduating people with degrees in order to replenish our workforce here in Minnesota?
Well, I think first and foremost is we have to be relevant to what the business community, particularly within our state, needs as a workforce. And that's a moving target. And when you've got a ship as big as Minsky or the university, it doesn't turn real quickly. Like, say, some of the more nimble, the Hewlett-Packards of the world. But we have to be better at predicting what skills, what training are relevant and needed by our business community. And, of course, that has a lot to do with partnerships with the business community in Minnesota, the corporations that at least theoretically are waiting for our graduates. And we owe it to them as partners, but we owe it to the students to be training them in relevant skills, relevant degrees that they can go out and earn a successful living. So I don't know of specific plans. I mean, there are recruitment plans, retention plans, and now I'm very glad to see that there's been a major shift toward completion. I think we've been measuring how many incoming students we have, slicing and dicing those demographics. We've been talking about moving from one year to the next, retention. But unless and until we really increase our completion rates, we really haven't accomplished that goal. So, again, I think it's a matter of relevance to the business community, listening to the business community, and predicting, which is the hardest part, what the business community and corporation community in Minnesota and elsewhere need in the next 3, 5, 10 years. And I know that's getting harder and harder. I think I used the example when I interviewed 6 years ago. I think I used the example of my son, and he was in fourth grade, and basically saying that the job that he and his friends would be holding when they hit the workforce essentially 98% of them don't exist right now. And I think that's the issue that we face, is instituting programs and curriculum and being ahead of the game enough to know that those things are what's really needed in the workforce. No easy task, obviously.
Carolyn?
Yes, this is Carolyn Williams from St. Cloud, and I'd like to know about your knowledge of STEM and also where you see this being, this is a very hot topic, and where do you see this going? Because I see things moving very slowly in our system with this.
I don't disagree with you, and I think STEM programs and STEM courses are just critical. Science, technology, engineering, math, it's at the core of what's needed in the future. I talked about relevance. I think you all know the numbers of how many engineers are being graduated in China and India versus the United States. It's scary and it's disgraceful. And if we don't get more young people in K-12 interested in science and math, we're going to have a void in those occupations that's going to be really damaging to the country. I agree that things are moving too slowly. At the last board meeting I was at, we had a presentation from the Center of Excellence. I forget the acronym, but it's the one that's engineering out of Mankato and the Northeast Higher Education District and others. And I was just so terribly impressed with their progress and what they're doing. And we started out with a good idea and created these centers of excellence, and then had to cut and trim some more. And their future is really in jeopardy, and I think that's just really a shame, because I think I was a skeptic of the whole Center of Excellence concept when it was first put forth, but I think there's been some great work done. But again, I'm frustrated, as most people are, with progress on a lot of these programs. But along with developing priorities, there's got to be resources to put into things that can move them along appropriately, and I just don't think we've had the resources to do it. So I don't disagree with your frustration at all. I think it's an area that we need to find ways to focus on better than we have.
John?
John Dorn from Mankato, Tom. Thank you again for applying and sharing. When you were speaking about Chancellor McCormick, you described him as a real visionary who met many challenges in his time here. And then I was jotting the notes as fast as I could, referenced helping the next chancellor to help the Minsky system in what it must become. And I jotted that down and am looking for a little bit more insight from you about what you see the system becoming or what it must become. You referenced the becoming or remaining or staying relevant in a rapidly changing world in terms of the content, but are there other areas where the system itself and how it functions that perhaps we do it because we've always done it that way, that you see are ways that we just can't continue to do it that way, given all the pressures and from all directions? Do you have any other examples, basically, I'm asking, about what you see the system becoming or what it must become that the next chancellor would have to deal with?
I think the system, I don't want to give too much credit to Roger Moe and the folks who decided to push these three systems together. I'm not sure they knew what they were looking to accomplish. I think oftentimes we combine things, whether it's divisions in our own company, and we assume that there are going to be cost savings and efficiencies, and not oftentimes those assumptions are incorrect. I mean, I keep hearing about the time at Minsky and the time at board meetings prior to the time that this chancellor and some of the current board members came on board, and it was, I keep hearing the term chaotic. So obviously a lot of progress has been made in terms of turning it into a real system that both serves the 32 institutions that are part of that system, but more importantly serves the students, a very, very diverse student body. It's about as diverse as you can imagine. And to me, again, I don't think there's anybody, any reasonable person that is saying that what we need is a Minsky identity, a Minsky degree that every one of those colleges and universities has to get in line, so to speak. Sure, we could create a more efficient system, but I think we would lose the precious part of Minsky, and that is the history and the tradition and the culture of those individual institutions, many of which have been around for a really, really long time. And so I want to speak delicately about creating a seamless, wonderful, efficient system, because I think there's a balance between creating a system that really serves those colleges and universities and the communities that they are in, and serves the students, given all the variety of student needs that we have. So many part-time, non-traditional, first-generation students, four-year students, two-year students just looking to increase their skills to get into the workforce. It's so complex that I think aiming toward a perfect system that is perfectly efficient is a mistake. But can things like, you know, the whole issue about credit transfer and other things that are being addressed by students first, can they be done in a way that helps students, particularly students attending more than one of our institutions at a time, can it help them be successful quicker, cheaper? I think there are a lot of places where we can make progress that don't impinge upon that delicate balance between the system, so to speak, and the member institutions. And again, those are just a few examples. The other issue that I know is going to come up eventually again, and as long as finances are what they are, it's going to continue to come up, and that is how many buildings do we build, and how many institutions can we support, and that's another delicate balance. If we're the system of access, which we have pretty much decided we are, then those institutions that are in the most remote and rural communities are really the proof of that philosophy. But can we maintain the rainy rivers of the world? And I say that even though knowing that this is going to be public record, and the Iron Range legislators will probably kill me for saying it, but I don't know. I don't know how long the system and the people of Minnesota can support 54 campuses. I know the crucial role that the Vermilions and the Rainy Rivers play in their communities, not just for access for students, but as part of the community. But those questions are obviously, with e-learning and so on, those questions are going to be more and more in our face, unless or until this state fiscal crisis gets past us. I just don't see how we can avoid those questions.
One time for one last question, Sonia.
Again, I'm going to reiterate what Nancy said, and thank you for your service, because I know your insight is so valuable. I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you, what do you see is needed on the Board of Trustees? What knowledge, what kind of person, or what... because you already serve now, and you have insight as to everybody who's around the table. So I'd like some insight, because we're going to make some big decisions today and tomorrow in who we're going to bring on the table to hopefully serve with you. And so if you're appointed and if your name goes forward, but what knowledge or what do you feel is needed that's lacking at the table that we should seek as we go through the day today and tomorrow?
I'll start out simply by saying, obviously, a diverse board, diverse in many ways, is always something to strive for. Our organization, the Northland Foundation, strives for that. Any well-thinking board, any board that really wants to serve a broad public, wants people of genders, races, people of different business backgrounds, education backgrounds. So I'll just put that out there initially, and that is a diverse board and diverse in every way is always something that I think whoever is electing or appointing a board member should strive for. But having said that, I don't think that specific knowledge is missing or specific knowledge is required to have a high-functioning board. I think you need people of integrity. I think you need people who bring something to the table. I don't think every one of 15 board members needs to be able to read a balance sheet, but you sure as heck need a few. I don't think everyone around the board should be a tech wizard, but if we're going to oversee the technology advances, we need a few people who are pretty savvy in that. So, universal skills, I don't say, well, we need more business people. We need another lawyer. I think what we need are people who can think broadly, who are there, motivated by the right reasons, that simply want to serve and serve well. I think you need people who are going to take the time to read, because there is a lot to read and a lot to digest, and scrape beneath the surface to look for the real underlying issues at any point. I was part of framing the original roles and responsibilities of for the Regent Candidate Advisory Council more years ago than I care to remember. I think 1988 we were formed. And I interviewed, over the course of the years that I was on the Regent Candidate Advisory Council, I estimated that I interviewed well over 300 people who wanted to be regent. And that's what I looked for. I just looked for people of depth and integrity and balance. What we don't need are people who are openly political. I just think that damages that board as well as any public board more than anything else. We're all political with a small p, but as soon as we start letting politics dictate what we vote for, what we prioritize, I think the system and the state really suffer damage from that.
Tom, we have time for about one minute of closing summary comments you want to make.
I had something, but I'll read this. It's, I think I said it already, but I'll say it in a different way. When I interviewed before this committee 6 years ago, I concluded my remarks by saying that I had no personal agenda other than to serve the state, colleges, and university system, the students who are served by that system, and the people of Minnesota who have high expectations of the workforce that is produced by that system. I stated then that I probably knew more about Minsky than 90% of the general public, but but only about 10% of what I needed to know to be a good trustee. Once I dove into the job, I learned that 10% estimate was high. Now, 6 years later, I really can't emphasize enough how important it is, just as on any governing board, to have some level of continuity and experience on the Board of Trustees. I think this is particularly true during these difficult economic times, and with the knowledge that in a few short months, we'll be launching the search for a new chancellor. So I've enjoyed this this interview and thoroughly enjoyed my 6 years on the Board of Trustees. I really feel like I've served as best I can, and if you think I bring the qualities to the board that you feel that board needs, then I would definitely appreciate your support. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom, and head back to the beach.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.